I want to start the sermon with a quote that I found. And this is from a poetry book called Venus in Arms by an author whose name is Chris Jamie, or Jammy, J-A-M-I. The quote goes, "In the age of technology, there is constant access to vast amounts of information. The basket overflows. People get overwhelmed. The eye of the storm is not so much what goes on in the world. It is the confusion of how to think, feel, digest, and react to what goes on." And I like this quote, and I picked it because it pretty much sums up the world today, and it's also pretty relevant to the message that we're going to have today. I'll try to paraphrase that quote. He says that the center of the storm, the very strongest part of the storm, where the winds are the strongest, that part of the storm in our modern world is that nobody knows how to think, feel, or digest what's going on in the world. He says that there's confusion about how to respond and feel about events, world events. We'll look at why there's this confusion, but right now I kind of want to study that term a little bit, confusion. So let's look at that term confusion. And you say confusion and you think, oh, well, it's kind of easy to explain, but it's not. So I want to ask, what is confusion? What is it? The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines confusion as a situation in which people are uncertain about what to do or are unable to understand something clearly. Another definition is the feeling that you have when you do not understand what is happening, what is expected, etc., etc. Third definition is a state or situation in which many things are happening in a way that is not controlled or orderly. So I look at that and you say, well, what causes confusion? Well, we can say that it's not caused by having only one true fact. You cannot have confusion if you have facts that everybody agrees on. For example, nobody is confused when it comes to believing that 2 plus 2 equals 4. Everyone agrees that's so. There's no confusion about it. Instead, confusion is caused, as that quote we read suggests, by having multiple and conflicting versions of what is considered correct. So if we had one group of scientists saying that 2 plus 2 equals 10,482,512, and another group of scientists saying 2 plus 2 equals 100, and yet another group saying 2 plus 2 equals 5, there would be confusion. There would be confusion. If, and only if, everybody agreed that each one of those answers was just as valid as another. There is no right or wrong answer. That's where the confusion would come in. In other words, confusion exists where there's a mixture of choices, all of which seem to be equally valid. And in fact, if we look at Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the American Language, it defines confusion as, in a general sense, a mixture of several things promiscuously, hence disorder, irregularity, as the confusion of tongues at Babel. Now, promiscuous in this case means characterized by or involving indiscriminate mingling or association. So when we think about confusion in a general sense, it's a mixture or the mixing together of several things without regards to right or wrong, plan or order, chaos or anything like that. It's just stuff thrown together. That's confusion. Let's look at that Bible example that was cited by Webster's 1828 dictionary, and that's the confusion of tongues at Babel. And we'll do that by turning to Genesis chapter 11. Let's go ahead and go to Genesis 11. And we're not looking at these verses so much as to analyze them or figure out what they mean, but rather to get a better understanding and appreciation of confusion. So I'm going to go to Genesis chapter 11 and start in verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So in this example, we can see that first, everyone, in a sense, agreed, or were forced to agree, that there was one language. One language, one correct language. There was no confusion. When somebody in that language said a brick is a brick, they knew what was happening. Confusion occurred when there were multiple languages. Each person was now speaking a language that, to them, made perfect sense. It was perfectly reasonable, perfectly logical, perfectly accurate. There was a myriad of languages, and there was no one correct language that they were using, at least as far as they knew. Many were probably convinced that they had the right language, and everyone else was just speaking mumble-jumble, gibberish, babble. Others perhaps thought that they were losing their minds. You know, they go, "What is going on? This is crazy." But it all boiled down to the fact that there was now no correct way to speak. And so what happened? The result was confusion. Nobody agreed on what was right and what was wrong in regards to language. It shouldn't surprise us to learn that in Scripture, Babel literally means confusion. And Babel, of course, is where the term Babylon is derived from. So Babylon is confusion. Would it be fair to say that Babylon or confusion characterizes the world today when it comes to religious belief? Would it be fair to say that? Sure. And when it comes to morality, doctrine, and ethics associated with religious belief, would it be fair to say that, as a whole, the world is all over the map? Sure, it's true. In the world as a whole, there's no consensus on what is right or what is wrong when it comes to religious belief. We have Islam and its various sects, Buddhism, Roman Catholicism, traditional Protestant Christianity in its various forms. We can go outside of organized religion. We can look at spiritualism. We can look at any number of things that people purport help them to be spiritual, help them to find God, any of those things. Thousands and thousands of belief systems, and when we come right down to it, probably millions or even billions, as each person on earth picks and chooses what parts of what religions they want to believe. A lot of individual religions. That's the situation in the world today. That's what it is. But would it surprise us to know that it's not just today that this has really been the situation for thousands of years? A confusion of religions has been the normal state of affairs. The pages of the Bible show that the confusion has been the rule rather than the exception. We looked at the Tower of Babel. That's one example. The people at the Tower of Babel were in rebellion against God. They were confused about what God, about the truth of God and what God wanted. When we go a little bit further, we can see that the story of Noah also showed mass confusion. People there almost totally forgot about God. So much so that only Noah and his family had the right solution to the confusion. So prior to the creation of Israel, it seems that God only worked with very small groups or even individuals. It seems like the truth of God, who he was and what he wanted, was lost among the various other beliefs as a whole, in the world as a whole. Confusion. Confusion. But then God decided to do something. He decided that he was going to establish a nation that had the truth of God. It started with Abram and eventually became the nation of Israel. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 19 and we'll see what God's intention was for Israel. Exodus 19. After God brought the descendants of Abraham out of Egypt, his desire was to build this nation. So beginning in verse 4 of Exodus 19, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So even though God himself, though, built this nation of Israel, we know from reading that the people periodically still fell into religious confusion. And he warned against that multiple times. He warned them about that. He told the Israelites that this was a distinct possibility that it was going to happen. Let's look at one example in Deuteronomy chapter 13. Deuteronomy. A warning against becoming confused. Deuteronomy chapter 13, verse 12. "If in one of your cities, which Jehovah your God has given you to dwell in, you shall hear one saying, 'Men, the sons of Belial have gone out from among you and have drawn away those who live in their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which you have not known.' Then you shall inquire and make search and ask carefully. And behold, if it is true, and the thing is certain, that such an abomination is done among you," and then it goes on to give the penalty for what they should do if they caught people trying to pull Israelites over to false religion. It was a distinct possibility that that could happen. The people of Israel knew the one right God, yet the nations around them did not. They did not. There was a confusion of religious belief even then. And again, Israel was not immune to that influence. And we know from Scripture, again, that many Israelites did go after other gods. It happened time and time again throughout the history of Israel. There was that confusion among Israel that is, again, documented throughout the Old Testament. I found that amazing. Amazing, isn't it? That God himself established Israel, yet confusion of who and what God was still remained. It was still there. And in fact, when we look at nations, ever since then, there's not been one nation on earth that has not been confused about religion. Even when America was considered a Christian nation, there was still a lot of confusion about religion. People were confused about the Sabbath. People were confused about the holy days. There were scores of things over time that had gone wrong with the religion that Christ established. Remember how confusion is caused by adding things to a mix with no thought of right or wrong. Take a belief from here, stick it in there. Take a belief from there, stick it in there. Take another belief, put it over here. That's traditional Christianity. That was traditional Christianity 10 years ago. That was traditional Christianity 50 years ago, and 1,000 years ago, and 1,500 years ago. No government on earth, save for the nation of Israel that God himself created, had ever been completely in line with God. There's always been confusion among governments and people when it comes to religion. How can I sit up here and say that? How can I do that? How can I sit up here and just make that statement? Well, it's because there has been no point of time in the history of the earth where the majority of its inhabitants were doing what Christ did and what Christ taught. No point of time. Zero. None. The vast majority of people on earth throughout history have never lived a godly life. And by, I don't mean that in a critical way. I just mean it was unknown. God was unknown. They've never known God or his ways. And there's an answer to why that is. There's an answer. And there's a reason why this is. And that's because for nearly its whole history, the people of earth have been under the sway of Satan. Satan. Go ahead and turn to 1 John chapter 5. 1 John chapter 5. We'll look at that. This is critical to know. Critical to understand our place in the world. 1 John chapter 5. And we're going to read something that John said. 1 John chapter 5, I'm going to read verses 18 and 19. He says that, "We know that whoever is born of God does not sin, but he who has been born of God keeps himself, and the wicked one does not touch him." Remember that protection for later. Verse 19, "We know that we are of God, and the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one." In verse 19, it's again interesting. John knew Jesus Christ personally when he was in human form. He recognized that even after the death and resurrection of Christ, that the whole world lay under the sway of the evil one, Satan. And that verse literally translates to like the whole world is lying down in evil and wickedness. Kind of like you made your bed among evil and wickedness. How can that be? How can that be? Many well-meaning Christians today teach that the death and resurrection of Christ freed the world from the slavery of sin, the sway of Satan. It did, but only if we obey Christ and what he taught. Let's turn to Ephesians chapter 2 and we'll look at that. Ephesians chapter 2. Verse 1 of Ephesians 2. "And you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins." And that's that analogy again of laying down in sin. That's the environment that we're doing. You were dead in those trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. Now that word, when we look at that word that's translated course in verse 2 is interesting because it elsewhere, and it can be translated as age. Age, as in a long period of history. This is the age of Satan, is what Paul is telling us here in Ephesians. This is the age of Satan, not the age of God. And in this age of Satan, he actively works to get people to rebel against God, to be disobedient to God. And this spirit of disobedience, I think we often don't have an appreciation for how strong it is. It's so strong and it's so pervasive that it influences us and touches us in many ways that we don't even think about. Things that we might not even associate with religion or God. Look at kids with their parents. How many kids do we know that are disobedient to parents? It happens a lot. Think about employees, employers. How many employees are disobedient? They'll try to get away with as much as they can just so they don't have to do what they're being told to do. We don't see that as disobedient. We don't think sometimes that that's disobedience. We make excuses, we find justifications, whatever it is, but that's what it is. Satanic influence is real, and it's real powerful, and it's got the world in its grips. And when you say that to non-church people, all right, people who are not familiar with God, with the Bible, whatever, it's a ridiculous statement, granted. I mean, they'll laugh at your face. I mean, it happens. They'll say there's no such thing as an entity that influences the whole world. They can't see it, so why would they believe it? They'll say, well, each one of us is free to make up our own minds about good and evil, and we just live our lives as best as we can. Nobody or nothing has dominion over me. Isn't that the mindset? Well, if we turn to Luke chapter 4, verse 5, as Bible-believing Christians, we have to say, you want to bet? Luke chapter 4, verse 5. And these are we're breaking into the temptations of Christ when Satan was trying to tempt Christ to sin, trying to get him to fail at his mission. Verse 5. Then the devil, taking him, we're talking about Christ, up on a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. So Satan, through what has to be supernatural means here, is showing Christ all the kingdoms of the world. And I looked at this and I couldn't find an answer, but it's unsure whether it's just the kingdoms of the time or whether it was kingdoms of the past, present, and future. Showing in a moment of time, in a twinkling of an eye, Christ, all these kingdoms. Verse 6. And the devil said to him, all this authority I will give you and their glory, for this has been delivered to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. He then states that, and it sounds ridiculous. I mean, if you don't believe that, it sounds ridiculous. He says that authority has been granted to him, the devil, over all the kingdoms of the world, and that he can give that authority to whomever he wishes. Verse 7. Therefore, if you will worship me, all will be yours. He says he would have gave Jesus all that authority over all those kingdoms, all those nations, if Jesus had got down and bowed to him and worshiped Satan. Now, does Jesus, the Son of God, the Messiah, does he call him out? Does he say, you have no authority over the world? You're a liar. Does he say, these kingdoms are not yours to give? You're lying. No, he doesn't. He says in verse 8, he says, get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. What's Satan trying to do? Satan's trying to tempt him to sin. This would only be a temptation for sin if Christ truly knew that Satan did have authority over the kingdoms of the world and that he could give it to Christ. That's the only way that this could be a temptation to sin. There would be no temptation for Christ to sin if Satan was lying about this. He would know. Satan had and has authority over all kingdoms, all governments, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, the United States, Great Britain, Canada, Venezuela. There's not one kingdom of the world that Satan does not have authority over. Why is that? The answer is simple. We already talked about it. It's because most of the people of the world, the overwhelming vast majority of people in the world, are anti-Christ. They're anti-God. They're being influenced by Satan every second of every day. They're in rebellion against God. Some knowingly, some unknowingly. Many are deceived. But Scripture says they all do the will of Satan. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 to look at that. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Paul writing to the church in Corinth, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3, "But even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, whose minds the God of this age," this is the age of Satan, remember, "has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. For we do not preach ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your bondservants for Jesus' sake. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God, perhaps, will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will." Most are captive to the will of Satan. And a large part of the reason is, a big part of Satan's arsenal is confusion. Confusion. Satan is highly effective in giving us choices that all look pretty good. Whatever we're predisposed to believe or want to believe, there's a belief out there for it. And Satan helps legitimize it. He says, that's valid. You can believe that. The truth of God is just one choice out of many. And practically everyone in the whole world, even among the church, is deceived and doing the will of Satan. I shouldn't say everybody in the church, but among organizations. That brings us to another point. Clearly, God is not hands off. He doesn't say, all right, Satan, do what you will, and step back. Look at ourselves as examples. God protects us. And we saw that earlier, if we stay close to him. And there's a good example of how this kind of works, the outline of it, in the book of Job. Let's turn to Job chapter 1. We need a Savior. We need someone to save us from the clutches of Satan, of sin. Job chapter 1. I'm going to start in verse 6 of Job chapter 1. "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it.'" This verse is a pretty clear indication that Satan has the power and the authority to be in our realm, to make changes in the earthly realm, to be here in the earthly realm. If you remember 1 Peter chapter 5, this verse sounds a lot where it says, "Your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Excuse me. Verse 8. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the works of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." So these verses indicate that God does have a personal interest and takes care of those that worship him. He protects us from the influence of Satan. Verse 12, "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." And we know the rest of the story, how Satan ultimately causes Job to lose everything that he held dear, how Job was tormented with disease, and how he ultimately lost faith in the goodness of God. And the purpose of it was that God showed Job that he had a flaw. And that flaw was that when the going got tough, Job was ready to question God. Job was ready to question God's wisdom and question his authority over him. And he ended up repenting from that. Now, if that can happen to someone who believes in God, that trusts in God, or is supposed to trust in God, imagine someone God is not working with. Or someone who refuses to let God work on them or with them. There's no hedge. There's no hedge. There's no protection. Satan has free reign. He's essentially using and manipulating them for his own purpose, which is always anti-Christ, always anti-God, always designed to diminish God, to diminish God's authority, to diminish God's rule. That's Satan's MO. And when he does that, he puts people like that into positions of power, influence, things that he can do to make God irrelevant to the lives of the people of the earth. That's our world. This is the age of Satan, and it has been for a very long time. And knowing that, what should our attitude be toward the world? And especially in American society today, where we can see Satan being unmasked. I mean, we can see it. We see it. I don't know if anybody else sees it, but make no mistake, that's what's happening. Satan is either so confident that he's winning, or maybe he's desperate because he's losing, but he's hardly trying to keep things under wraps anymore. He's hardly even trying to keep things on the down low. Oh, he had a deal. He had to deal with us for a little while with a relatively large group of people that had nominal Christianity, that held values that were different, that were against the values that Satan held. But really, when we think about that, that was really just a little bump in the road for Satan. Let's look at sexual sin. Adultery, homosexuality, rape, child sex, fornication, incest. All sexual sin has been acceptable in the world much longer than it's been unacceptable overall. We have been blessed to live in a time when at least some of God's instructions have been retained in our culture to a certain degree. But even that's going now. That's disappearing now. What I'm trying to do is put things into context. Putting things into context. The world as a whole has always been overwhelmingly evil and overwhelmingly anti-Christ. We have to do away with the notion that man has the capability to bring about any meaningful, lasting change or positive good that lasts any length of time in the world. By length of time, overall, in the big picture. We cannot. We cannot. This is the age of Satan. Knowing this, what should our reaction be to evil and sin? Anger? Disappointment? And sometimes those seem like perfectly natural reactions, and they are. They are. They're natural. They're natural in the world of Satan. But they're not godly reactions. If we're going to get angry and offended over every sin that the uncalled commit, we're going to be very miserable and very busy all the time. I know I go here a lot, but let's turn to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5. I go here a lot in my sermons because I need to go there a lot in my life to remind myself and reinforce how I'm supposed to be. And to keep that goal clearly in mind. And that's what we should all be doing, to keep this goal in mind. Galatians chapter 5, verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. In the face of evil, or in the face of good, this needs to be our characteristics. In the face of sin, this is our response. The people that are doing such things are confused. Confused. They've not been called by God. They don't know the truth. They're under a strong satanic influence. We're not. We've been freed. We've been freed. We know the truth. And because of that, we're held to a different standard. A different standard. They're not held to that same standard. They're not called. And they never have been held to that standard. We're held to that standard, not them. And once we come to this realization, it's really a game changer. Public discussion of morality and ethics among those not called by God, if you try to discuss morality, the standards of our morality with someone else that's not called, it accomplishes next to nothing. It's divisive. Which is exactly why Satan uses it. He uses it against us to get us worked up. I see that a lot in the church, especially when it comes to politics and voting. If you're on Facebook, you'll notice that there's quite a few individuals who really get into that. And I lived and breathed politics for a number of years. And I eagerly voted for a person that I supported because he was right or because the other guy was wrong. Whatever thought was being basically shoved into my head. And all that, you know, all the other people were just idiots who were brainwashed that supported someone else. You know, I mean that's the thing that gets drilled into your head. And I'm happy to be on the way to escaping that trap. I stopped voting when I joined the church, but still was engaged way too much in the us versus them trap of the political process. Have we ever thought of that? How our whole political process, and I know people disagree, and that's fine, our whole political process in the United States is designed, specifically designed to divide us as a people. It's how each side gets votes. Our system makes us feel bad if we don't pay enough attention to elections, but at the same time, it banks on the fact that we don't pay close attention to elections. If our politicians, they want us to pay attention just enough to get us to the voting booth, but they don't want us to look too deep because they've got their system. Unless we cut ourselves off from the media unless we cut ourselves off, we're all being influenced by Satan to one degree or another when it comes to what we believe politically. Okay? We have no idea on our own without the media telling us what's going on in the world of politics. Think about that. Most of us don't know somebody personally involved in national politics. And Satan's not called the prince of the power of the air for nothing. He controls what goes into our minds via television, radio, print, and even the internet. You often hear that phrase, well, I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Well, why would that be a choice? Why would anybody vote for any evil at all? I was looking at one guy's Facebook page, thinking, I wanted to do it, I didn't do it, but I toyed with the idea of putting together a church, a God voting guide. Okay, you know, you see those little voting guides, candidate's name, what they believe on the positions, yes, no. So, Church of God voting guide. Keep Sabbath? Trump? No. Clinton? No. Believe that God created holy days we should observe? Trump? No. Clinton? No. Believe that God created certain animals to be eaten by his creation and certain animals not to be eaten? Trump? No. Clinton? No. Believe that keeping pagan holidays is wrong? Trump? No. Clinton? No. You can go on and on and on through our whole belief system, through the whole Bible, really, and you're going to get no for every candidate that's ever been. Because when it comes right down to it, there's never been a candidate that believes as God's church believes. Ever. And again, most of us have never, ever personally met or know a national candidate. I think that much, in many ways also, much of the Church of God now who we see engaged in never-ending political discussions somehow feel like they've missed out over the years and they're trying to make a difference. And nothing wrong with that. We have biases. I mean, I have biases, of course. I like Mr. Trump because he's a businessman. I'm a businessman. I understand where he's coming from. When he talks about taxes, when he talks about businesses, when he talks about economic policy, I look at that and I say, yep, yeah, you know, he's exactly right. That's exactly what's happening. I understand he has certain moral values, but others don't. I know that he's got, if one of the moral values he has that is disturbing is that he's let work consume him. And he'll tell you this. He's let work consume him all his life. His God is work. His God is work. He's labored and labored and labored at almost the expense of everything else to be successful. Sure, right policies might make good economic sense, but if we do have a recovery in the United States, what's ultimately going to happen? Satan's going to use that, whatever excess there is, wealth, for his own purposes. It's not gonna change. The bottom line is that God calls people of all political persuasions. He calls us out of the world, out of that system. And that system, again, is a snare and a trap of Satan. We're up against a very powerful being. And don't think for that one moment that he won't use our patriotism, our morals, and our ethics against us, because he will, and he does. All the time. Some people might be of the opinion that we're letting Satan take control of society, and I've heard this argument, and culture if we don't publicly and actively through voting oppose the agenda of plug-in political left, political right, whatever. I, at least in my experience, the only good that ever came out of my voting was it gave you a great sense of satisfaction that you could release this tension and this anger over all that time that's been feeding up, building up inside of you. It's a chance to do something about it. But in reality, there's not enough Christians to influence any policy in the United States. And when we talk about Christians, we are talking about people who live and follow God's way of life. And we certainly don't have any influence over any other governments in the world. And that's not giving up. That's not giving up. People have argued that against me. That's not giving up. That's just coming to the realization that there are many things beyond our control. And that's one of them. God is large and in charge, and there's no reason for us to get worked up about it. Let's turn to John chapter 12. John chapter 12. We're going to go turn back to the ruler of this world. Before he was crucified, Jesus shared some information with his followers about the fate of Satan. John chapter 12. Verse verse 31 of John 12. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world, and remember, this is the age of Satan. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. Jesus knew that his perfect, sinless life would soon mean that the age of Satan was about ready to come to a close. It was about ready to expire. Go ahead and flip forward to John chapter 16. He said something else. John chapter 16. And speaking of God's Spirit, in verse 8 he says, "And when he has come, he will convict the world of sin and of righteousness and of judgment, of sin because they do not believe in me, of righteousness because I go to my Father and you see me no more, of judgment because the ruler of this world is judged." Satan will be judged and his power will come to an end. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 18. His reign is going to come to an end. In chapter 18 of Revelation, we're going to see the last days of Satan's reign on earth. Surely not all of it, but a little bit of description of Satan's last days. The last days of confusion on earth. Revelation chapter 18, verse 1. "After these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird." Look at those verses in the context of the definition of religious confusion. It's saying confusion is ending. Confusion is about to come to a close. Babylon, the system of confusion, was confusing because the truth of God was mixed in with every other religious belief, no matter how demonic, no matter how vile, no matter how evil. Dwelling place of demons, prison for every foul spirit, cage for every unclean and hated bird. Coming to an end. Verse 3. "For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury." That's the kicker right there. All nations have participated in that confusion. There's not been one nation that has not been given into false religious practices of one kind or another. Not one. And not only that, but abandonment of God, as these verses say, has led to a world of greed. A world of greed. That's why all the merchants are sad. A world where the bottom line is the almighty dollar. That sounds a lot like our world. Very much like our world. Verse 4. "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues." Yeah, this is a plea to come out of the confusion of false religion. But it's also a plea to recognize just how far-reaching the tentacles of this confusion reach. Verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." We're looking at a world where no nation acknowledges the God of the Bible. Where no nation obeys his rules, his laws, and his precepts. In our world, nations either embrace false gods or they embrace a pantheon of gods. All gods are equal, none is superior. That's the prevailing attitude in the world today. This is the world today. But that won't be the world tomorrow. Most people have never known a world where God directly rules everything and everybody. Nobody in this room. We've only known a satanic world of confusion. But one day, and very soon, that's going to change. The whole world is going to know who's really in charge. Go turn back to Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11. And we're going to be talking about this a lot in the upcoming weeks and days leading to the Feast of Trumpets. But I did want to read this verse. Revelation chapter 11, verse 15. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ, and He shall reign forever and ever." This is it. At that time, the kingdoms of the world will no longer belong to Satan. They will belong to Christ. And we will then, for the very first time, live in a world where there is no more confusion about religion. There will be no confusion about God. The truth will be known and the truth will be taught. And that one truth, that one reality, will be the one truth and the one reality for the entire world.